first part should be known in this contract as the party of the first part.
The witness will comply under the, this I got a C rule.
Judge Hurd is stumped by this case. I've also misplaced my judge hammer.
The justice system works swiftly in the future now that they've abolished all lawyers.
My client will suggest that your client drives my client back to your client's flat, where your client will play some James Taylor.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 509. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How you doing?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
Doing great. Is there going to be something that takes away your ability to do the Cosby breakdown in this episode? Because I've been waiting for this friggin' thing for a week and a half, Andrew, I think.
I am confident we are going to get there, and it's going to be worth the wait.
But first, 80 minutes on the Kraken sanctions.
On the Kraken sanctions.
Yeah, now I can't pronounce either of those words now that I made that joke. Kraken sanctions is how humans do it. But Andrew might say Kraken? No, Kraken. Kraken sanctions. Down. Down.
So I like to think, thanks to us, but the nation's eyes were riveted to 5 hours and 42 minutes of a district court hearing in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Michigan last week. And it was amazing. It was amazing in every conceivable way. And I want to help our listeners who watched it understand what it is that they watched. And again, this is going to be just about coterminous with our laud-awful movies, breaking down, making fun of, and going really point by point on some of the more absurd things that came out in that hearing. So I thought I would explain what's going on here and what's going to happen next, what the city of Detroit is asking for, what's likely to happen, right? All of this stuff. So the main argument, what this hearing is about, is Rule 11 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And that governs how lawyers conduct themselves in federal court. And that's why this hearing is really, really important, right? Like, there are lots of other sort of potential sanctions. And sometimes, you know, I've talked about infrequently the number of times that I've had to move for sanctions where it has been unclear where the involvement is with the position the client wants to take, whether the lawyer is facilitating that. So, for example, I have a pending lawsuit right now in federal court in Maryland in which we have an ongoing sanctions order. And that sanctions order is pursuant to the court's inherent authority. And I've talked a little bit about that, and this is a public case, so I'm not talking out of school here. But it had to do with repeated email conversations that were sent by the other side to my client and to my client's employees, donors, volunteer. My client is a nonprofit, right? To their donors, to their volunteers. And on a half dozen occasions, I called up the other side and said, hey man, can you stop doing that, right? Like, you've sued us in federal court. If you have something you want to communicate to my client, they've hired a lawyer. One of the benefits of hiring a lawyer is you don't have to deal with a barrage of stupid emails. And
that's what Andrew does for a living.
Right, exactly. No, seriously. Like, this is a real benefit I bring to my clients, right? And so the other side, rather shockingly to me, said, no.
Wow.
We think he has a First Amendment right to continue to, you know, say stuff. And I was like, Well, I disagree.
Don't and I think the that's court how the law disagree. Works. Yeah.
Yeah. And the court did disagree, right? So I don't bring that up to like pat myself on the back, although, you know,
look, no, why not?
I'm a good lawyer, right? But to contrast with how narrow. So those sanctions were, I moved for sanctions pursuant to the court's inherent authority because they would not have fit under Rule 11, which I'm going to read to you now. So Rule 11 governs things said by lawyers. It is called subsection B, representations to the court. And it says, by presenting to the court a pleading, written motion, or other paper, whether by signing, filing, submitting, or later advocating it, an attorney or unrepresented party, that is for when you represent yourself, certifies that to the best of that person's knowledge, information, and belief, formed after an inquiry reasonable under the circumstances, four things. And those four things are, one, it is not being presented for any improper purpose, such as to harass, cause unnecessary delay, or needlessly increase the cost of litigation. Two, the claims, defenses, and other legal contentions are warranted by existing law or by a non-frivolous argument for extending, modifying, or reversing existing law or establishing new law. Three, the factual contentions have evidentiary support or, if specifically so identified, will likely have evidentiary support after a reasonable opportunity for further investigation or discovery. And four, the denials is just the converse. The denials of factual contentions are warranted on the evidence or, if specifically so identified, are reasonably based on a belief or lack of information. So this is the minimum standard for me signing a paper in federal court. I'm saying, hey, I put my name on this, and I am certifying when I put my name on it that this paper that I am filing, to the best of my knowledge, information, and belief, formed after a reasonable inquiry under the circumstances, does not do any one of these four things, right? And these are conjunctive. This is an and. So I cannot do any of them, right? That is, use the court improperly to harass or annoy or cause unnecessary delay, that I am either arguing under the law or for a good faith extension or new interpretation of the law, and that my contentions either have evidentiary support or I think I will uncover that during discovery. And the reverse is true regarding my answers to your contentions, to the other side's contentions. This should not sound like a particularly high bar to clear. It is not. And in fact, lawyers use the phrase Rule 11 sanctions to describe when they think, you know, opposing conduct is as below and beneath the call of duty as you can imagine, right? Like, so if I were to say to somebody, counsel, you are treading awfully close to Rule 11 sanctions here, that is as stern a warning as I can give to opposing counsel.
Short of like, my dad could beat up your dad.
Yes. Well, that is, I mean, that's just factual. So since my dad is a proud listener of the show, he's going to enjoy that. So you may also recognize, right, like it applies only to things that the lawyer has submitted. The operative verb is presenting to the court, right? I guess it's a gerund, right? Whether by signing, filing, submitting, or later advocating it. So whenever I say something to the court, as an officer of the court, I have to meet these minimum requirements. The city of Detroit has argued, I think, persuasively, that nobody involved in this nutso Kraken lawsuit that was dismissed after 7 days met that bare minimum under Rule 11. And that's what this hearing was set to resolve. And I need to add, we talked about this last week when we first discussed and flagged for everybody that in episode 506 that this hearing was going to be available for viewing over the internet. Yeah. 13,000 views on the court's website.
Which is a lot for a boring law thingy, I imagine.
Which is a super lot for a boring
law thingy. What would an equivalent like thing like this have if it weren't this? Like, you know, 7 views?
Yeah.
Just right, be right. You watching it 5 times and then who like their families watching it twice?
Yeah. No, that is exactly, it would be only the parties involved. And critically, the judge in this case, Judge Parker, said, we're going to do this over Zoom, right? So it's going to be a virtual hearing. But I want everybody who has appeared on any of the plaintiff's pleadings to be there in person, virtually in person. all of the lawyers hired Douglas Campbell to represent them. Pro tip from this passed over from Cleanup on Aisle 45. If you are a plaintiff and your lawyer hires a lawyer in the middle of your lawsuit, that's not real good sign for you as the
lawyer. it's the scene. I think it's probably both The Simpsons and Futurama where they're talking to the lawyer and it just shows the bars, you know, and then like at the end of the scene, they're like, well, good luck with that. And they walk away and it's actually the lawyer was behind bars the whole time. It's one of those shows. I can't remember which it is, but it's a fantastic joke.
Yes. And that may well be the case here. So all of the lawyers involved, and we can run down the list, Sidney Powell, Lynn Wood, Greg Roll, Emily Newman, Julia Holler, Brandon Johnson, Scott Hagerstrom has successfully managed to keep the lowest profile during this hearing, I think.
Yeah, I don't recognize that name even.
And Howard Kleinhandler. I believe now all of them have retained Doug Campbell. Doug Campbell, I need to tell you, I have done the due diligence, is a respected attorney in Michigan who handles attorney grievance cases, right? So they went to the best and they said, hey, we have this thing. We need you to represent us. And then they moved the court. They said, hey, can we not appear in person? Can we appear through counsel? And the court issued the ruling like 12 minutes later with the legalese equivalent of, did I stutter?
Yeah.
Which was, no, the court specifically ruled that all of you appear in person. That means in person, and then parenthesis, virtually. So why did the court want them there in person? Because as I went through on Rule 11, the question is, when you've submitted a paper to the court, you are certifying that to the best of your information, knowledge, and belief, formed after an inquiry reasonable under the circumstances, that none of those four things were true. And what the judge wanted to do in a cross-ex as stunningly effective as I have ever seen is ask each and every one of the lawyers to start off with a wild, preposterous, and stupid allegation in the complaint, and then say to the lawyers, so, anybody want to tell us what inquiry you did to verify that this is true? And then there would be stunned silence.
Not all at once. Right? You know, take turns.
The court frequently said, don't everybody jump in all at once.
Yeah.
And then Doug Campbell would say, well, I think, and then would proceed to give the arguments for why they didn't have to do an independent inquiry. And those arguments were typically in the form of, well, this was putting forth an expert witness. And like, you expect the expert witness to do the inquiry. But the court was prepared for that argument. And the court's response was, well, what did you do to inquire whether your expert witness was, you know, an expert witness or not?
Yeah, that seems like it would be a get out of jail free card. If you're like, as long as someone says they're an expert, you can put on anything, a Holocaust denier, if they say they're an expert and there's no, you don't have to do any due diligence on that.
That is the logical extension of the argument. And I need to tell you, I thought the lawyers on behalf of the city of Detroit did really an amazing job at sort of sticking to the argument and saying, look, what they're trying to do is essentially, you know, launder their bad arguments, right? They're saying, oh, if we raise this in 50 different lawsuits, then we can quote another lawsuit, or we can quote, you know, the expert witness we put up in Pennsylvania and say, look, all we're doing is quoting from pleadings. How could that not be the case? And said over and over again, look, don't let them do this, right? Don't let them essentially give you the runaround by saying, well, it's person A who told person B, who told person C, who, right? Keep your eye on the ball of the fundamental question of, was the appropriate due diligence done under Rule 11? I think my favorite portion came very late in the day when Julia Holler, who, let's be honest, had the worst day on this, cried on camera several times.
Wow.
It was very close on other occasions. It was not a good showing. Julia Holler was asked with respect to the allegations involving Dominion voting machines, the broad question, So again, and again, this was like number seven of, so, you know, did anybody on behalf of any of the plaintiffs do any work to validate whether this was an appropriate opinion or not? And this time, Julia Hauer said, yes, Your Honor, I can tell you that I personally read through the Dominion voting manual, and we had conversations with the expert regarding the procedures, and we reviewed this, and we did this, and we did that. And you could see her, you know, thinking like, you know, a not particularly bright child going, I've answered the question. Mm-hmm. And that's where the judge sprung the second trap, which was, well, good, Ms. Haller, when you uncovered that the evidence was to the contrary of your witness's opinion, yeah, what did you tell the witness? And there was just, you could see like literally the color drain out of her face and go, oh, I hadn't thought about it. You mean I have to not only do due diligence, but I also have to act on it?
Yeah.
And it was truly a
like
a
they thought
moment.
They could just kind of sort of cross the T, you know, and a little bit dot the I, and they're like, no, you actually have to do those things. You can't just do what looks like you did those things.
Exactly. So this did not go well for any of the lawyers. And I thought then I would let you know kind of where things stand, but also the three different categories of arguments that are being raised here. And my view of each of the three of them. And let's start with Emily Newman. Emily Newman came to court prepared with the it's my first day defense. She was represented by Thomas M. Buchanan from Winston & Strawn, who is an impeccable $2,000 an hour lawyer. Okay. Weirdly, as we record this morning, she has hired another lawyer, Timothy Galligan. I'm going to give the link in the show notes to his LinkedIn page. Timothy Galligan is basically the me of Michigan, right? Like, again.
So good deal. A great lawyer at an affordable price.
but in terms of his background, he says, right, for more than 20 years, I've represented clients of all sizes in a wide variety of litigation and transactional matters across many industries. My focus is on providing timely and practical legal advice geared to the business matter at hand at a cost-effective and proactive approach to achieving a prompt and successful conclusion to litigation. I could say that about myself, right? I have extensive litigation experience in the automotive, construction, real estate, insurance, and information technology industries. Well, not the automotive part, but the rest of those, right? Particular matters include contract UCC business tort, shareholder and partnership disputes, non-competition and trade secrets, intellectual property litigation, including copyright, trademark, and unfair competition, tried numerous cases to verdict and in arbitration, including $3.8 million jury verdict in Wayne County in a commercial fraud case. My transactional experience, that means non-litigation drafting documents, includes negotiating and drafting of agreements for business acquisitions, financing, real estate, blah, 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 blah. If you were about to be disbarred, I would not recommend hiring my law firm. I'm real good.
You're killing your business, Andrew. You're killing your business.
But that's not my area of expertise.
Yeah.
It's not Galligan's area of expertise. It's not Buchanan's area of expertise. So this is a super weird position to take and to spend an awful lot of money.
Well, whose expertise is it? I mean, it seems, I'm sure there's
Donald Campbell. It's
every
his
different medical sub practice that you're like, who would get into specifically anal something? You know, like you're like, who gets into that? But who gets into the like, I want to get into law to protect really terrible lawyers from consequences. That's what I am here to do. Who is that person?
The answer to that is Donald Campbell, who represents Sidney
Powell. I guess maybe that's the answer, is that, oh, nobody else is doing it, so I can be the super expensive, like, niche lawyer for this thing.
Okay. Yeah, and look, he's good at what he does. Okay, so, like I said, her defense is, it's my first day. They've said repeatedly throughout the hearing, she worked a total of 5 hours on the case, was a contract attorney working from home during COVID. In case you're tempted to feel the tiniest bit of empathy or sympathy for Ms. Newman, I'm going to link you to the Un-American Bar's Voter Suppression Attorney Database. Emily Newman has appeared in 4 of these Kraken lawsuits. Huh. So, you know, it's my first day only goes so far when you
so
are
she
a serial
offender. Hour and 15 of work on each of them? Is that?
No. She worked 5 on this one, and I don't know how long on the others. Right. Yeah. Good point. And did not disclose was not asked, but did not disclose that she has been involved in other cases. She also had a six-figure job in the Trump administration. So I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for Emily Newman. She knew the kind of people she was getting into bed with when she decided to sign off on a lawsuit that says that the election was stolen. That, I think, is if anybody escapes here, it will be Emily Newman, mm-hmm. and I don't think she will. I think the court is sufficiently unamused at this lawsuit that they're going to grant the city of Detroit all of the relief that it's requested. I'm going to get to what that is in a minute. But that's the first sort of bucket of arguments. The people who say, "Yeah, I don't know why I'm here." Right? The next set of arguments were brought by Lynn Wood, and his argument is, "I never signed anything. I'm not really in this case. Ask anybody. They will tell you I didn't do anything to help them," which is a weird kind of position for an attorney to take. But you know, even my co-counsel will tell you I'm not helpful. But I will point out that Lynn Wood tried this exact same trick in Delaware when he was when his pro hac vice was removed in the Carter Page litigation. We talked about this on OA. And the judge's opinion revoking his pro hac vice, in footnote one, says, "Mr. Wood, in his response," that was the show cause order, "tells me he is not responsible for appearing in the Wisconsin litigation as he is listed as counsel for notice." Okay. Huh. My reading of the docket is that he was one of the counsel of record for the plaintiffs and thus fully responsible. And he is trying the same trick here in Michigan. He says, "Look, I don't have a little slash S. I never signed any of the pleadings. My name shows up on the signature block. Like, I told Sydney Powell she could call me late at night when she's bored and, you know, bounce ideas off of me. But, you know, I didn't do this." That argument is not responsive to Rule 11. It's why I read it super slowly. And it says that if you submit anything to the court, the key is not necessarily signing, but signing, filing, submitting, or later advocating it. And Linwood has public statements too numerous to mention, including telling the same court in Delaware that he was counsel for plaintiffs in the Michigan litigation when he was attempting to establish his bona fides when he applied pro hac vice. Right. So I think the court is going to have no problems seeing through that. But Lynn Wood has made a very specific argument to which this court has laid a delightful trap. And I'm going to get to that trap in a minute. I will also point out Lynn Wood led to, I have never ever seen this before, the filing of a subsequent motion the same day of the hearing that says, "Request for a show cause order to require Lynn Wood to show cause as to why he should not be sanctioned for his conduct in and after the sanctions motion," right? Which, if you've seen that meme with the, like, you know, "Yo, dog, I heard you like, you know," and somebody posted the, like, "Yo, dog, I heard you like sanctions in your sanctions, so I committed sanctions violation during the sanction hearing." But true, Robert Davis, on behalf of the city of Detroit, filed a motion for order to show cause why attorney Lynn Wood should not be held in criminal contempt for violating local rule 83.32 D3 and E2. And that is, here I'm going to quote from it, "During the six-hour hearing, plaintiff's counsel Lynn Wood was repeatedly disrespectful to the court and defiant of the court's directives during the hearing," which is true. Then, and you would not file a motion just based on him behaving like an asshole during the hearing, which he did. Then, quote, "surprising, Mr. Wood's total disrespect of the court's orders and directives continued after the conclusion of yesterday's hearings." So what happened was, when the hearing ended, the parties asked if the court was going to make the live stream public. And the court said no. And local rule 83.32E2 says, "The recording or broadcasting of judicial proceedings by radio or television or other means is prohibited. Taking photographs, making video, or other audio recordings of any type are strictly prohibited." And immediately after the hearing, Lynn Wood went on his, have you heard of Telegram? I don't know. It's some kind of crazy right-wing thing.
Telegram. Yeah. Is that another one of the like right-wing version of X app that they had to get off of?
I think so, because it says he has an 840,000 followers on Telegram.
Yeah.
And posted Sidney Powell's closing argument. Closing statement, closing deranged ramblings, which, by the way, were, when Sidney Powell made them, we will talk about this, were made to be broadcast out to the kind of lunatics that think Donald Trump is secretly still president, right? So in other words, despite being told by the court not to, Linwood took a portion of the hearing and rebroadcast it out on the internet. That led Detroit to say, you should sanction him for that too. It also led Douglas Campbell, Linwood's ostensible attorney, although my favorite moment came in the hearing. I shared this on Cleanup on Aisle 45, but it's too good not to share here, when the judge said, Mr. Campbell, you represent Linwood as well. And Campbell said, well, in as far as anyone can, I guess.
Yeah.
Which, you know, also not a great sign. And then Linwood said, I might have to get new counsel. So anyway, it led Campbell, who again has been by far the most competent lawyer in this parade of nonsense, to move the court to release the whole video, right? And to say, look, there's a First Amendment right. We're all interested in this. People were out there with it already. We think that you should release this, because then the entire video will be out there and everybody can view it, sort of make appropriate decisions. And the court, again, within 20 minutes or so said, not going to do that. And the reason that I'm not going to do that is because you do not need the unedited video in order to file your supplemental motions, which is the only thing remaining to do here. So there's nothing for me to do. A pretty clear smackdown, says the court, in fact, threw the virtual doors to the July 12th proceeding wide open, far wider than could have been accommodated had the hearing been conducted in person. As you guys note in your own motion, more than 13,000 people watched live, viewing the proceedings just as they were conducted. As to counsel's suggestion that video is needed to prepare a supplement brief, attorneys routinely prepare such briefs following a hearing without video or audio recordings of the proceedings, and often without a transcript. It is these reasons ordered that your emergency motion is denied. And the reason for doing that, the only reason for doing that, I actually predicted that she would release the full audio and visual. The only reason for doing that is to come back and hit Linwood with sanctions for how he conducted himself during and subsequent to the sanctions hearing.
A sanction sandwich, as you say.
It is. And then there's this delightful trap, and I need to make this as clear as possible. So Linwood's argument is, I don't have anything to do with this case. We've already said it doesn't matter. Like, it's probably enough for him to get under Rule 11 in this case, because he has appeared in the signature block. He has never discounted. He's represented in other jurisdictions that he represents the plaintiffs. He's subsequently ratified the stuff that he said. But Judge Parker is super smart here. And what she did was, Linwood said repeatedly throughout the hearing, ask anybody, ask all of plaintiff's counsel on this call whether I had anything to do with anything, and they'll tell you no, right? And Sidney Powell, in her closing monologue, said Linwood had nothing to do with this, right? The judge said, I'm not going to do that. What I am going to do is I'm going to give you the opportunity to file a supplemental brief. It's due within 14 days, so July 26th, right? So about a week from when you're listening to the show. Here's the thing. Linwood will have to, either on his own behalf or through counsel, sign that brief. So the court will say, right, you are absolutely responsible for the plaintiff's brief, blah, 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 blah. Moreover, when given the opportunity to speak to this court under your signature, as represented by and through counsel, you submitted X pleading, which failed to distance yourself, which ratified the earlier work that you had done. And look, Linwood knows this, right? We've talked about, like, Sidney Powell is an idiot. Linwood had a promising legal career until he went insane. That's why he kept saying, Your Honor, I want you to just do an evidentiary hearing right now and decide. Just talk to the lawyers, because then he could stay silent and he can continue to play this little shell game of, oh, well, you know, I was just available, but I didn't really say anything. I didn't affirm, blah, blah, blah. And here they're requiring him to put his name to a piece of paper and take a position. And that will be used as the basis of Rule 11 sanctions. I don't want to spend a lot of time on the last argument, which was the only thing left raised on behalf of the primary lawyers involved here, Sidney Powell, Howard Kleinhandler. And the argument is a very technical one involving service of process. And it basically says you have to follow Federal Rule 5 in order to serve the papers under Federal Rule 11. And I've talked about that process before. You've got to give them 21 days. You know, you send it via first-class mail and also, you know, give them an actual copy via email. The judge made it very, very clear, said, you're not contesting that you never saw the pleadings, right? You're just contesting the form of the service, the very technical argument. And Campbell said, yes. So they're going to brief that. I feel very confident that the city of Detroit's argument is going to attach an affidavit that says, yes, you know, we sent this in accordance with Rule 5, and the court's going to say, yeah, that's good enough for us. They are not claiming they didn't know what the motion was about. They're just claiming a technical defect. And it goes all the way back to OA1. When the court hates you, a technical defect is not a great place to put all your eggs. So here's what the sanctions are asking, and I think they're going to get everything, okay? One, they want the taxpayers reimbursed for the expense paid to defend this litigation. Again, remember, right, this is the state of Michigan and the city of Detroit, and the DNC also moved to intervene. But basically, like, taxpayers have funded this litigation.
Oh, my God.
And they said, yeah, we shouldn't have to. This was a nonsense lawsuit. We want every dime we've spent from the beginning of this lawsuit repaid to us. They're going to get that. Number two, the request was that the lawyers should be punished. And this dovetails with number three, that punishment should be strong enough to deter future misconduct. In other words, that there be some kind of punitive sanctions on the lawyers above and beyond just defending, you know, just reimbursing.
So what's within the jurisdiction here? Because this is still like a lawyery lawyer thing, right? Or is this actual, like, you can have criminal anything on you?
So these are all civil penalties, but they are within the discretion of the court. So, yeah, the court can say, and it is typical. It's not typical in a Rule 11 case. Let me contradict my contradiction of myself. I have never been involved in a Rule 11 case in which the prevailing party got all of the costs of all of the litigation. But the caveat is I have never been involved in a case in which I filed Rule 11 sanctions in response to the complaint, right? In which my position was, you have no business being in court. This is nonsense. That is essentially the argument here, is we shouldn't have had to do any of this. And it strikes me as plausible that that they're going to get everything from day one. And then the court will have to say whether it thinks that is a sufficient punitive deterrent against all of these crackin' lawyers to prevent them from continuing to behave this way. And then the fourth request, and we've talked about this, is, and this is an A and a B, that the court, the way Doug Fink put it in closing arguments was that they never be allowed to appear again in this or any other court, which I love. So refer them to their own state bar associations and also refer them to the state Supreme Court so that they are, quote, permanently barred from appearing in the Eastern District of Michigan. I think he will get that order. And so we have a lot of fronts, you know, multi-front fight here. But I feel good. You can hear it in my voice to watch, you know, my profession, which was so debased during the Trump years, to see people fighting back. And it's not just funny. It makes me pray.
Can they just never be lawyers again? Is that where we're getting to? Because that's what needs to happen.
That's what happens in an ideal world. It is why Emily Newman is spending tens of thousands of dollars, because she's looking at this going like, holy crap. Like, I was just right. 'Cause she truly is a junior partner on all of this. And Emily Newman is not Sidney Powell, right? Like, she does not have a career on Fox News ahead of her. She has a career of being disbarred ahead of her.
Wow.
And watch out, you know, when you lie down with dogs, right? So,
yeah. Well, we're all out of time, so we'll have to leave the Cosby thing for next week. Trying to kill me with this editing? All right.
I'm trying to kill you with this edit. We got to do it. We got to at least do some of it.
This show is brought to you by WordTune. This is a super cool thing I can't wait to tell you about. Folks, you know how Andrew will say, I'll put this in the show notes from time to time? What he means by that is Thomas will put this in the show notes. I'm the person who writes the show notes, but I hate writing. I'm not naturally a writer. Maybe you're like me. Maybe you're not naturally just a gifted writer. Maybe you need a little help from time to time. And this could apply to anyone. I mean, maybe you have to write an email. Especially, we're all working from home these days. You got to do a lot of emailing, maybe more than ever. Maybe meeting recaps. Maybe you're writing a blog or a resume. These can be some tough, high-pressure situations where you want to make sure you have your wording just right. Well, imagine how much easier that would be if you had an expert on call to take a look at drafts whenever you needed them and to help you out. WordTune can be exactly that kind of writing partner for you, but in digital form. There's no need to waste time agonizing over the perfect sentence. With WordTune, you can hit deadlines on time every time. WordTune instantly provides options based on your original words that can help you take your writing to the next level. Your writing impacts how people view you, and it can shape your future prospects. That's why it's important to write as well as possible. So like I said, I use it for the episode descriptions. I have a weird habit of often starting sentences and going on for too long. Well, WordTune is great at making that very helpful suggestion to me, like, hey, maybe this sentence you wrote is way too long and meandering, sort of like that last sentence I had. WordTune helps me fix all that. WordTune is the first AI-powered online writing tool that understands meaning so you can feel confident that what you're writing is as smart as you are every time. It understands what you're trying to say, and it suggests ways to make your writing more clear, compelling, and authentic. WordTune uses the most advanced language processing technology out there. No other writing tool does what WordTune can do. It's a total game changer. And here's the thing. WordTune works anywhere you're working online. That could be Google Docs, Slack, Outlook Web, WhatsApp, and more. My listeners can try WordTune for free at wordtune.com/opening. Get help writing your emails, reports, presentations, resumes, blogs today. Go to WordTune, WordTune.com/opening.
Hey, everybody, this is an ad for Blue Blocks. So, you all know how much I love reading 800-page Supreme Court decisions and breaking them down for you on the show, but let's be realistic. What that means is I'm sitting at my computer for sometimes 16 to 20 hours a day, and, like, I get eye strain. I get headaches. It sucks. So, you may have seen blue light glasses. These can be prescription if you're like me and you need prescription glasses, or they can be clear lenses, right? And basically what it does is filters out the blue light. Now, there are a bunch of knockoff super cheap products. I gotta tell you, I like the Blue Blocks blue light computer glasses. Number one, they match my prescription. It was super easy and straightforward. Number two, I think they look pretty good. They are stylish. And most importantly, since wearing them at the computer, it really has reduced the digital eye strain, reduced the amount of times that I just get those killer headaches from staring at my 3-screen setup for so long while reading all of these opinions. So I can't recommend Blue Blocks highly enough. Look, they come in non-prescription, prescription, and readers. Blue Blocks makes glasses for every need, right? They have the blue light that I've talked about for digital eye strain, but they've also have Summer Glow for helping with low mood, and also the Sleep Plus for improving your sleep. They have other amazing products, including, I might give this a shot, the 100% blackout sleep masks. So if you've got ambient light, I like that. All of it, backed by science and tested. Blue Blocks ships worldwide in rapid time. They've got easy return and exchange policies. So here's what you're going to do. You're going to head on over to blueblocks.com/OA, and you're going to use the coupon code OA to save 15% on any Blue Blocks products. So that's blublox.com, blublox.com/OA. Use coupon code OA to save 15%.
At long last, what is this Cosby dish, this Cosby intel that you have? I've been dying to hear.
Two things, okay? The first, and this was listener Natalie on Twitter asked this via question, and it's an excellent question, and it is, I think, a really, really important aspect of the ongoing argument over the Cosby decision, which, by the way, like, that was our episode 504. I think it was well received. I think even the folks that disagreed with us, I think, respected kind of where we came up. there was some disagreement over, like, I think it's okay broadly to want to, extend your Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. And so asking the question of reasonable reliance is sufficient. I don't agree with that argument, but I can understand it. And I can see a really good faith basis for making that point. Remember that the second point upon which the Pennsylvania Supreme Court had before it, and upon which the only judge, Judge Saylor, in dissent on the Maine on the press release said, oh, but by the way, I would reverse on the question of introducing the victim testimony from prior cases. We kind of talked about that as an aspect of Pennsylvania law. Natalie points out correctly that Rule 413 of the Federal Rules of Evidence would have decisively answered this question. So, in other words, if Cosby had been prosecuted in federal court instead of state court, there is no question that the prior victim testimony would have come in. And I'm going to read that rule in a minute. But I wanted to kind of sidebar. In fact, well, why don't I read it now, right? So, in 1994, the Federal Rules of Evidence were amended to say 413A, permitted uses. And it says this: in any criminal case in which a defendant is accused of a sexual assault, the court may admit evidence that the defendant committed any other sexual assault. Mm. The evidence may be considered on any matter to which it is relevant. Okay? So that whole balancing unduly prejudicial stuff that we talked about, 403, 404, would not have been an issue if this were in federal court, right? The testimony of the prior victims would have been admitted, period. Take that argument off the table. Now you might ask, how do you get into federal court for sex crimes? And the answer is, it's pretty narrow. There are a handful of statutory offenses, right? 18 U.S.C. 2241, if it is within the maritime or territorial jurisdiction of the United States, right? That is the District of Columbia, right? Yeah. Or, right, other territories or in a federal prison. And obviously, prison rape is its own subject.
Right, yeah.
So then you get into federal court. You get into federal court under 18 U.S.C. 2251 if you cross state lines to exploit a minor. That's the Jeffrey Epstein case, right? On which Acosta, the Trump-appointed prosecutor, declined to indict. Or you get in under 18 U.S.C. 2252A, which is, and I recognize the discussion over the archaicness of this term, but it's how it's referred to in the federal statutes, which are the child pornography statutes. Mm-hmm. I want to bracket and say that I think the arguments that it should not be referred to as child pornography, which suggests agency on the behalf of victims, I agree with 100%. That's what they're called on the statute. So.
Gotcha.
It looks like it's really, really hard for me to figure out how many sex crimes wind up being federal as opposed to state. It looks like about 20%, right? So about 4-1 or 5-1, kind of hard to figure out. So in other words, most of your sex crimes are state crimes, the overwhelming supermajority. But if your state follows the Federal Rules of Evidence 413, then Cosby-type evidence of any other sexual assault is relevant. The court may admit that evidence in your subsequent criminal prosecution. With that as background, now here's the dive, archaeological findings that are looking.
Yeah, what is the thing that we're trying to explain? Like, what is the, because that episode seemed complete to me, seemed to make sense. What's the kind of the missing link that all this is about?
Well, I wanted to nail down the victim testimony stuff, which we just did with 413. But the other thing that you asked me and I couldn't answer was, why did Bill Cosby sit for four depositions, right? And to what extent, if we're talking about, you know, reliance, right? To what extent did that show up in his depositions? And I think I finally figured it out. And it is nothing like what anybody reporting on this story is talking about.
Interesting.
So I cannot find that Cosby sat for four depositions. I can find that he had two full days worth of depositions. So that may be four volumes, right? A morning and evening, morning and evening. I went back to the full docket and I read every pleading in the constant civil suit. And here's what I was able to figure out, okay? On November 21st of 2005, Constant, that's the plaintiff, and again, we're naming her because she has publicly named herself in a civil suit. She filed a motion for sanctions based on Bill Cosby and his lawyer's conduct during those depositions. That's a pretty serious charge, okay? This is docket number 48. And it is linked on the opening arguments page. That motion is extensive. And when I say extensive, I mean 50 plus pages of quotations from the various deposition from those two depositions. Spoiler alert, this motion for sanctions was never adjudicated by the court. And the reason that it was never adjudicated is because the day before the hearing was set, right, to be heard on this particular motion was when the case was settled.
So was this part of the bargaining and settling stuff?
This is, you know, speculation on my part, but as somebody who's been practicing law for, you know, a quarter of a century, when you see there's about to be a hearing and the parties have settled all claims against each other with finality the day before that hearing is scheduled to begin, that tells you that one party really, 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 really did not want to go to that hearing.
And did that prevent us from knowing some stuff? Like, that? Did that keep some of this information private?
So, great question. So, this pleading was filed under seal, because the depositions were taken under seal. And the court then immediately was faced with a motion to intervene by the Associated Press that said, hey, there was a 65-page motion for sanctions, and you've sealed that. We would like to see that. We think that there is probably a public interest in knowing what's going on in that sanctions motion. And the court at that time said, yeah, we're going to continue to keep this sealed. We are holding on abeyance the AP's motion to intervene and their motion to unseal. And then there was about 6 months worth of debate back and forth on whether that document and other documents that referred to it would be unsealed. And eventually, that was denied, but denied without prejudice, right? So in other words, saying, you know what, I'm not going to unseal this at this time, but I'm going to leave open the opportunity for you to come back and move to unseal at a later point in time. By the way, at the same point that, the same time that the Associated Press is arguing, hey, we want to see this document, Bill Cosby's lawyer's response to this document is as bad a response as anything I have seen up until the sanctions hearings we just talked about in the A segment, right? He never responded. So in other words, this was as I told you, this was a 65-page motion for sanctions. That 65-page motion for sanctions included 50 pages of speaking objections by Bill Cosby's counsel. And when I say speaking objections, what I mean is that we've talked about this before, but during a deposition, you do not have the judge in the room. You just have the parties, their lawyers, and a court reporter. And you can ask hearsay in a deposition. I can say, okay, Thomas, like, what did Jane tell you on X and Y date? And objection. If your lawyer, your lawyer says objection hearsay, I say, fine, make that argument at court. Mr. Smith, you may answer.
Objection, I don't want to answer.
And so what lawyers, and really, there are broadly speaking, only two grounds upon which you can object as a defense counsel during a deposition. You can object as to the form of the question, right? That is, it will not be clear on the record what this witness's answer means because you've asked a compound question. I'll give you a great example that bad lawyers will say, Mr. Smith, is it true? Have you ever been arrested? Have you ever been subject to any disciplinary proceeding in any court, arbitration, or other proceeding against you, right? Well, you could see immediately that the other side might say objection as to form because I might go back and cherry pick and go, I asked Mr. Smith, has he ever been arrested? And then he said, yes, right? And, you know, and if I'd asked a question like that, and you know, look, we all do that. I'll sometimes joke on the record, be like, yeah, you know, to a valid objection to form, I'll be like, yeah, you're right. That was a bad question. Mr. Smith, have you ever been arrested?
Let me try again. Does your mom know you like Nickelback?
Yeah.
So it's about separating it out, not getting that combined answer. Okay.
I'll ask them seriatim. Those are all the reasons why you object as to form. Objecting for something that is beyond the scope is trickier, and I'm not going to go through the full list of it. But again, it basically says, this witness is here to testify broadly about X. You can ask him about that, but like, don't ask irrelevant stuff. And the standard is relevance is likely to lead to the discovery of potentially admissible evidence or to make a fact more or to make a potentially relevant fact more or less likely, right? So I have very, very broad latitude for what I can ask. A speaking objection is when instead of saying objection as to form or objection beyond the scope, defense counsel will say, objection, he doesn't have to answer that because, you know, and will try and coach the witness in his explanation. So I'm going to read a little bit of an example here. This was the first time, as far as I can tell, that the questions about quaaludes came up, right? So plaintiff's counsel representing Constance says, question, did you ever obtain quaaludes again from any other source after the ones you had been given in the prescription that were no longer available to you? And then Cosby's counsel, this is O'Connor. What time frame? Don't answer the question. So Troiani tries again. Have you ever gotten any prescriptions from any other doctor which drugs would have a similar effect to quaaludes? O'Connor, during what time frame?
They said ever.
Troiani again. Yeah. The time frame we have here is from 1976 when we have the first Jane Doe we've been discussing through the year 2004. And then O'Connor, I think that's incorrect. The only Jane Doe that talks about quaaludes is T. If you have other Jane Does, Ms. Troiani, I'm not talking about quaaludes. Mr. O'Connor, if there are other Jane Does that talk about any other drugs, I will allow that, but there is none. And you're suggesting there is from 76 to 2005. And then Constance's lawyer says, Mr. O'Connor, you're deliberately disrupting this deposition. You have made that position clear. I believe that you're wrong. We do not agree that the drug that was given to our client was Benadryl. We have the right to explore, especially now that your client has admitted illegally obtaining another drug, which could have a similar effect. We have the right to explore whether or not he has done that, if that is a pattern in his life. And then I'm not going to continue, but it is, you know, here's what you have a right to explore. You have a right to explore what he gave your client. And then she says, you've made that position clear, and now let's move on. And then I will tell you when you read this, it is textbook coaching the witness, speaking objections, and it's 50 pages of, and then you will see, right, Cosby is a, quote, good witness in that when he is coached to give a particular answer, he will then give that answer, whether it makes sense to him or not. So that's this document. Cosby's lawyers never responded to the substance of it. They moved to strike to say that the allegations were scurrilous. Constance lawyer's response back to that was, again, kind of like the Lynn Wood. This is why it was a great lead-in. The response was, your motion to strike is full of Rule 11 violations and supports the reasons we want sanctions against you. I'm going to upload that to the site and include it in the show notes as well. It is the Cosby response on motion for sanctions, and it's hilarious. It really is. Like, yeah, all the reasons why you should be sanctioned are the reasons why you're not responding to our motion for sanctions. That's where we are as of December 2005, and so the court untangles the motion to seal, and then sets a hearing and says, "Hey, what we're going to do is hold a hearing that will begin on June the 9th at 8:30 a.m. And that order was entered on June the 6th. On June the 9th, the next entry in the docket is Order that plaintiff's motion for sanctions is denied as moot. Order that defendant's motion to strike is denied as moot. Plaintiff's motion to consolidate is denied as moot, etc. And the reason why that's in there is because over that weekend, right, that's a Friday to a Monday, is when the parties settled the lawsuit.
Mm.
So that happens on June 9th, 2006. There's some additional stuff. The case is dismissed with prejudice. There's another response to a motion to compel by the National Enquirer. But this is forgotten for 10 years.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. It just sits there and nothing happens. And then the court, kind of looking at its own docket, 10 years later, January 12th, 2015, sends out a notice. And I'm going to include this notice in the show notes. It's uploaded on our website. And the notice says, hey, pursuant to our local rules of civil procedure, rule 5.1.5, documents filed under seal have a two-year period in which they remain under seal unless there's a reason not to, right? Like it's sunshine. People deserve to know what's going on in court. So in accordance with rule 5.15c, this is to notify you that these documents are going to be unsealed unless you advise us in writing within 60 days that you object and tell us why, right? And the documents that were set to be unsealed included the sanctions motion. And all of a sudden, the Associated Press was like, oh, that's right. We wanted to see those, didn't we? And so they filed yet another brief. They renewed its request. And this time, it was granted. And the court said, yep, we're going to let you take a look at these documents that were filed under seal. Super straightforward. The ruling, I'm going to read from it, says, now, nearly 10 years later, the Associated Press has requested that the documents be unsealed and made available to the public. Defendant, Bill Cosby, opposes the request. Plaintiff has not asserted objections to the request. That's smart. The issue before the court is whether the defendant has shown good cause under Federal Rule of Procedure 26C to keep the documents under seal. And without going through that, they didn't. There were not good reasons to keep it under seal. And so that sanctions motion is what came out. The quotations from it regarding the extensive use of quaaludes was what caused all of the women to come out of the woodwork against Bill Cosby in 2016. So all of the stories that are saying, like, we have, you know, the full depositions, no, you don't. I've been everywhere. You cannot get those depositions. Huh. But what you can get is 50 pages of quotations, which are real, real bad.
But hold on. You're saying 2015, because the Hannibal Buress thing was in 2014, I think. So, I mean, I feel like that also could...
I do not mean to suggest that there is linear causation.
Okay.
But I mean, at this point, this was when now the Associated Press had this sanctions motion in their hands and was able to go back and reconstruct and go, oh, they proved an ongoing pattern that there were lots of these women. And by the way, Cosby was as unhelpful as anybody can get. As a defendant in the deposition. So, you know, when I thought that was really important in contrast to the way in which he was portrayed in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court opinion as, you know, like, oh, well, you know, he had the letter, so he sat down and was truly helpful and cooperative. No, he definitely was not. He was obfuscatory to the point of necessitating the filing of a 65-page motion for sanctions. And his lawyers took that so seriously that they made him settle the lawsuit so as to not go to that hearing.
So I guess for everybody out there, this is a complex lawyer thingy that you're describing. I'm having a hard time grappling with it. I guess let me ask the kind of the terminal question. You've kind of described some, you know, for a couple weeks now, something that really illuminates what's going on. If someone wants to share this show and they want to say, here's this revelation about the Cosby thing, what is the summary of that? What do you think this really illuminates that people aren't getting elsewhere?
The takeaway is, when I read the Pennsylvania Supreme Court opinion, it led me to believe that thousands of pages of Cosby's deposition transcripts were released to the public, and that that provided a roadmap to all of the other victims, which then led to the second trial.
Right. Oh, and crucially, it's that then the argument was, well, these depositions were only done under the, you know, mindset that he was cooperating for another thingy, right? Is that what
you're exactly trying to say? Right? Okay. On reliance on the press release that said he would not be prosecuted.
Okay.
The reality is that what was released was about 50 pages of quotations from his depositions, and far from being a roadmap, they were the exact opposite.
Yeah, well, it sounds like they're just his lawyer. Did he even say anything? It sounds like his lawyer just saying, objection, he doesn't have to answer.
Well, there are some quotes of what Cosby said as well.
Okay. But it's specifically designed to show that it wasn't helpful.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So what that means is there was a tremendous amount of independent investigative work that was done once this motion for sanctions became public, right? That's what I mean to say, right? In addition to, as you point out, some other victims had come out as early as 2014. The idea that you can draw a direct line A to B to C is, I think, further refuted by what actually got released.
Yeah. So this makes it even worse.
Yes.
Okay, great. Cool. That's what we're here to do, everybody. Make this awful Cosby story get even worse. How did this decision happen? This is so egregious, Andrew. Why in the world did this happen? We already did an episode on it.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by HelloFresh, folks. You know what HelloFresh is, but if you didn't, you're in for a treat. I keep talking about it, and it's because I still really love it for all the same reasons. Let me tell you why. With HelloFresh, you get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. Skip those trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. And that's why it's America's number one meal kit. Seriously, I don't know what we'd do without HelloFresh. It is so much easier to have someone send you the full ingredients, everything you need in the quantities you need it each week for delicious meals. And it gives you that variability. You often don't know what you haven't tried. And when you're trying to come up with something to eat each and every week, and you're trying to also make sure it's healthy, you're trying to make sure it's maybe varied, so you're not eating the same thing every single day, HelloFresh helps all of that. It cuts out that stressful meal planning and the grocery store trips so that you can enjoy the cooking and get dinner on the table in just about 30 minutes or less. And that will save you money, by the way. It's 28% cheaper than shopping at the grocery store and 72% cheaper than a restaurant meal without sacrificing the quality. And that's key because we tend to spend way too much on that takeout if we don't have HelloFresh. And that's why we love HelloFresh. So I'm telling you, you should try HelloFresh. We tried it. We never looked back. It makes our lives a lot easier, honestly. And you'll be enjoying more delicious food than you ever have if you've never tried it. So go to HelloFresh.com/OA14 and use the code OA14 for up to 14 free meals plus shipping. One more time, that's HelloFresh.com/OA14. And use that code OA14 for up to 14 free meals plus that free shipping. That's a lot of free meals, so you've got nothing to lose. Try it out. You'll get a bunch of free meals if you use our promo code OA14. And if you try it, I think you'll find out why HelloFresh is America's number one meal kit.
And thank you!
And now it's time to thank our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats at patreon.com/law. And I'll start us off. Thank you, too. Now here's something we hope you'll really like. A Hotel of Crime. Comedian Aaron Trahan, a.k.a. Game Jumper X. KellyWovit.com. I make stuff on a loom with my hands. Come buy it. Choo choo. Steam engines may not technically be better than diesel, but they are much more fun to look at. That thing in the attic. Market report. Hiking equipment was trailing. Elevators rose while escalators continued their slow decline. The Fat Jedi. Eating cake and drinking Emperor's Brewery beer in the Death Star canteen. Potato Face. If Thomas can't pork the streak, he can at least streak the pork. Liberals own guns too. Support root cause mitigation, not ineffective gun control. That guy. Check out Gems of Truth and Beauty, a creative guided journal for personal growth by Hope Wallace on Amazon. Huh, okay. I have here an affidavit, and if I could just get an evidentiary hearing, you would clearly see that I am not a potted plant. 100%, Thomas deserves way more credit for his role in making the left-wing, non-shitty atheist podcastosphere. Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Social justice alchemy. We cut down that twerp's hickory. Tell Morgan Gatamson, Zach Bloom, Ray, Pizza School the Corgi says, hi, Thomas. Yes, this is my real name. It doesn't make sense to me either. Follow me on Instagram anyway. Pizza School the Corgi is as confused about their own name as I am. LiveBaseballScorecards.com. Legal Eagle is so handsome. California employment, work accident, or litigation questions, call or text Attorney David Nitka, 310-776-5879. Again, 310-776-5879. The Smiths. Andrew, thou art a gober-mouching Zoilist. Get thee hence. Praise be unto Hamilton. That mansion is vote 50 is our fault, not his, so let's get at it. Crazy dog, horse, goat, chicken lady. Rest in peace, Brandon Bernard. We must abolish the death penalty. Budget botanist on Fiverr. Plant of the week. Agave tequilana or sparkling docky plant. Ooh. Family is asparagaceae, like the veg, not a cactus. Okay. Sparkle Donkey Tequila, put a pin in that. Now take out the pin. Weird, this pin says Sparkle Donkey Tequila, but I'm not sure why. Public service announcement. The official opening arguments office supply of the week is the red swing line stapler. Yep. East Coast Mary. New book, The Greatest Gift of All, A Logical Path from Religion to Humanism by Mark McLean. Out now. Oop, we got another move. Three. Knight to C3. Okay, I think that's going to do it. So that's white to move. We're going to go knight to C3. Yeah, threatening that queen. Seems like a good move to me. All right, that's the official move, everybody. Knight to C3. Sorry for making y'all try to say my friend's cat's name. I was proving to her that I'm a patron. Land. This enters tapped. Tap for black or red. 1 BR. Until end of turn, this becomes a 2-2 elemental creature with X. This gains plus X plus 0 until end of turn. Lava Claw Reaches, I think, is the name of that card. Lava Claw Reaches, I believe. Another one of those man lands. Those are good ones. Adam Borchoff, legal services for this podcast are provided by the law offices of Smith & Coin. Brian K, I like my pork streak paired with at Casa Agria and at Emperor's Brewery Beer. 75% of Tulare County's DAs have less than 2 years experience and they're doing felonies. Some are only provisionally licensed. Starting to question Legal Eagle, seeing as he agrees with the Pennsylvania Supreme Court about Cosby being tricked. I know you clarified that last time, but more on that maybe later. Lee Sharp, GDT says, they said they released the Kraken, but it turns out they're Kraken lacking. Yep. Thomas Kleberg, Buddy Freaking Geyerson, followed Morgan on Twitter, now seeing a different side of the platform. Supreme Court justices should have 18-year term limits, and so should Conrad Michaels. No coin at this firm has ever failed the bar exam. Two fabulous lesbians. Sorry, y'all, if I had a nickel for every time I forgot to change my patron name, I would have a lot of nickels. By the way, we both agree this list is getting too long. We plan to up the rate to $20 an episode to reach your name. That would shorten the list by quite a bit. Edgy Veggie, Bob Newhouse, Sassy Italy Tours, can't wait for Europe to be open again. Les Deux, Les Bien Fabuleux, Jennifer Chakowski, Horsey McHorsey Face, Equestrian, D&D minus cameo, question mark? More like imminent dough, main. John Brown did nothing wrong. Mike Hall, Evie Huntington, Harvard alum, no hood. Two, E takes D5, Queen takes D5, how many moves Silas makes the wiki? Been a dick since 64 and not about to give it up now. After all, nobody laughs at a Peter anymore, I think. Oh, so fluffy, Torsten Peel of the Satanic Temple. Elect Thomas Smith president, American Honky Tonk Bar Association. Support your local Peruvian restaurant. Angry Macface. Penelope is glad Sydney got sanctioned for terpsichore. The Books That Burn podcast reviewing fictional depictions of trauma since 2019. This is not the greatest patron name in the world. No, this is just a tribute. Support AfricaPartnersMedical.org. Arranging volunteer U.S. MDs and RNs to seminar the latest science-based practices to MDs and RNs probably some in Africa. I don't know. I'm completing the thought. But yeah, that's cool. AfricaPartnersMedical.org. Oh, Wayne, anyone who ever lost at poker knows better than to try bluffing a Texas bankruptcy judge. Murray Gregerson. La, 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 la. Listen to the S choir. Get it, S choir. Minneapolis live show. Come for the subpar baseball. Stay for the subpar football, hockey, and men's basketball. a series of symbols that I can't read. Actually, we can stop reading Patreon names anytime we want. It's not a contract and consideration is ongoing. I wish our newborn would exercise his right to remain silent at 4 a.m. Society for the Protection of the Third Amendment, celebrating a perfect record since 1792. Put your boss on a performance improvement plan past the PRO Act. Your Honor, I'd like to submit my allegation via interpretive dance. Crimer, no criming. Jake, Seattle Pete, Guardians ad litem of the galaxy, Christopher Brown, Philly Live Show 2022, I'll bring the scotch and cheese sticks, who's bringing gritty, Stirring Wildwood, oh my god, it just hit me, sorry I haven't 7 days, oh it is Stirring Wildwood, I knew that, gosh, I couldn't think of it. Yeah, nice job, Stirring Wildwood, that's the one. Lawful Copter says, Andrew and Thomas, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for everything you do. Objection, strangling Uncle Frank, I'm going to allow it. MR, OA Live Show in Sydney, Australia, please, I won't be vaccinated till October at the earliest, thanks, government. Your turn, Andrew.
And thank you to Odin's Bar Exam Pro Tip. Don't have a baby 5 months before the exam. that seems like a really good pro tip there. Robert M. Judge, I didn't get served with proper papers, and Spider is too an expert, and I want my juice in the yellow cup. Lou, shout out to 5D Chess with Multiverse Time Travel. It's a great game on Steam. We can all hope that Joe Manchin is a fan. Our council advises that nobody gets to put the Eli in feline. Another Minneapolitan waiting for our live show in Minneapolis. Not quite, but good enough, close enough for non-lawyer work. Marble, Colorado live show. Is that really a city? Marble, Colorado? Nikomo Koska, famed soldier of fortune, at your service. Polly Hernandez, Christ, 7 years of college down the drain. Metacon 7 has a pot for pins and a pot for beans. Emily Rainbow Spence, the best cardboard crack dealer in the Maritimes, the Deckbox, Halifax.com. Jason Copas, I was in Towson last month and I wanted to visit Andrew's office, but didn't want to make it weird. Well, yeah, you know, you have business. Feel free to come by. I'm not there that often, though, but. Strict Mutiny. This profile name is hilarious in the context of some other podcast. Oh God, the court has become sovereign citizen crazy. Strong opinions with no legal basis or accurate citation. Nate Drex. Sanctions are a kraken. Take burger restaurant naming advice from a podcast. My fully stocked basement bar is your fully stocked basement bar for a Philly Live Show Platinum event. You pick what's on tap. That's a great offer. Jeff Gelbach, Jennifer Cratch, accepting suggestions for verbally writing down questions mid-month for Q&A using Hey Gorgle. No idea what that means, but yeah. That's great. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio, laughing my ass off because Thomas knows more about the law than a coin does. John Bilderback, GiveToModestNeeds.org, GiveToModestNeeds.org. My friend's cousin mixed Coke with Cop Rocks and he died. Stephen Balticate Sandoval, interesting that the Texas GOP thinks using procedural tactics to block votes is wrong. Not that, Chris Wallace. Philip Kaiser, Andrea the Arbitrary and Capricious. COVID showed me I am the kind of guy that wants a little prick. Don't miss this fall's zany new comedy, Uncle Frank and Antifa. That's good. Absion, dude. Payne Strumpet, sorry for making you use that last one for so long. It was dumb anyway. Jonathan, Lord Kinbote, no, Your Honor, I am not a cat, nor am I a potted plant, but I am a karaoke legend, if that helps. Uncle Frank is just pissed because Antifa left him. What are the odds that two people would independently? Milo Mead's song wishes all Stephen Breyers a happy retire now. Alfred Wallace, join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Parsh Lives Matter. Navani and Raboniel are two fabulous lesbians. I don't want to believe, I want to know. I feel targeted because my fellow patron keeps rejecting my Patreon names out of hand. False. Anonymous, wordorigins.org, your source for word and phrase origins. My witty names aren't original, and my original names aren't witty. A series of bar suspensions, each more suspendy than the last. RIP, notorious RBG. Nerdgnostic sells art on Society 6. They said I could be anything, so I became two fabulous lesbians. Derek, I don't pray, but when I do, it's for evangelicals to get vaccinated. Our kitchen is your kitchen. For an eventual Seattle live show platinum dinner, the offer stands. Woo. Big easy blasphemy. It's kind of nice having a competent federal government again. SummitShuffleboard.com. A string of unpronounceable characters. RondaTheDork.com. If opening arguments is joining the MSW network, does that make Allison Andrews boss? Malika Chandler. They said I could be anything, so I became two princes who adore you. Which apparently is some grunge song reference. Anyway, Soggy Pants. The 1929 Apportionment Act is unconstitutional, preventing states getting reps relative to population. Ape Priori. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. De jure belly at Packies at last, baby. Heather L., Matthew Vernon, Adam Costa, Jeremiah's My Fancy Microwave Emporium, Ian and Alley, Jay Alden, Walt, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick. Why does Andrew drink so much scotch? Mostly because of just throw it on the stoop and see if the cat licks it up. David in Brooklyn, Sam Donnell, Mitchell. I'm sympathetic to this patron name. True story, apparently fraud doesn't vitiate sanctions in federal court. I agree with that 100%. Natasha Crunchwrap wants you to support the Justice Policy Institute, Sam Buck, and of course, our all-time great, he who shall never be dethroned, Conrad Michaels.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE. The only thing that could cap off this depressing Cosby episode is to see if I porked my streak or not.
All right. This is a question within an assumption of diversity. So truck driver from state A, bus driver from state B were involved in a collision in state B that injured the truck driver. The truck driver filed a federal diversity action in state B based on negligence, seeking $100,000 in damages. Parenthetically, you seemed to question at first whether this would be diversity. This is textbook diversity,
right? Oh, it is. Okay. Yeah, so it doesn't matter that it happened in state B.
No, because think about it. This is the original, like, you don't want to get homered, right? Like state A is right. Visiting state B. Truck driver from state A is visiting state B, hits somebody. You don't want him to have to go to the local courts and, you know, have to deal with, Judge Rufus. Everybody knows him, right? You want him to be able to get into federal court.
I guess what threw me off is the whole like, yeah, but also you're obeying the traffic laws of state B. Isn't that relevant? I don't know.
Yeah, but the question is, who do you want to adjudicate those laws? Right?
Okay.
Do you want, you know?
So this is a diversity thing. I got thrown off by like where it happened. But anyway, I don't think that.
Yeah, totally what you're going after is a really narrow exception. It's got to be a case where the defendant is in the same jurisdiction and then tries to remove to federal court, you can then remand it back to state court. Because the plaintiff is master of her complaint. Plaintiff can bring in state or federal court as they see fit. The defendant can remove on diversity grounds, but not if you've been sued in state court for which that is your home state. Because again, that gets rid of the Homer inference, right? So I think maybe because we've talked about that precise situation in respect to one of the other questions. So I think maybe you might have been thinking of that narrow exception that gets around federal diversity jurisdiction. But it doesn't matter because you weren't distracted by it. You were like, okay, not sure this is jurisdiction, but the question assumes that there's jurisdiction.
Yeah.
So then it is, what law of negligence should the court apply? You eliminated B, the court should apply the negligence law of state A, the truck driver's state of citizenship. That's a great elimination.
Okay, I might have gotten lucky, but I mean, we're in federal court in state B, and it happened in state B. That was my reasoning, but it sounds like, does that capture it all, or is there something else that I should?
Well, we're about to get
okay,
there.
Okay. No, I meant just for eliminating B. But
for eliminating B, that's plenty to eliminate B. Right? The fact that it was his state of citizenship, that doesn't mean anything, right?
Okay.
You also eliminated C. The court should consider the negligence law of both state A and state B and apply the law that the court believes most appropriately governs negligence in this action. You said, that seems like an attractive distractor, and I'm going to get rid of it. I will explain in a minute, but that's also a good elimination.
I was a little out on a limb on that.
Yeah. So it comes down to A or D. The coin picked A. The court should apply the federal common law of negligence. You picked D. The court should determine which state's negligence law a state court in state B would apply and then apply that law in this action. It may help you to know there is no federal common law of negligence. So A cannot be correct. Remember, federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction.
Yeah.
There is, don't write in, right?
What happens in DC?
There is an area of federal common law where Congress gives the courts power to develop substantive law for things like antitrust. Okay. So there is this really narrow area of federal common law. But by and large, and the bar will test those exceptions. But by and large, there's no such thing as federal common law because there certainly is no substantive federal common law for things like negligence, because federal courts are not courts of general jurisdiction. They're courts of limited jurisdiction. They can only take the cases that are properly before them. They can't build a body of common law. So Coin is 100% wrong. Why were you correct? You were correct because the state looks to the choice of law rules of the state in which it sits in order to determine which law to choose. Now, as you pointed out, the state will absolutely choose State B's laws here, because the accident occurred there, and that is going to be the most important decision. But the way to think about this is, suppose both parties were from State B, okay? And suppose they both get involved, that they're going to the same vacation site in State A, right? So both parties are from West Virginia. They're driving through Maryland to get to the Eastern Shore for a beach vacation. Both of them have an accident in Maryland. Then when they get home, the plaintiff living in West Virginia decides to sue the defendant living in West Virginia. And because there would be no diversity there, they would be in state court in West Virginia. And so, as we've talked about before, West Virginia, that West Virginia state court would have to figure out which state's law to apply. And West Virginia would then say, oh, okay, given our choice of law rules, which says, first, you pick the state that has the most, the state law that has the most substantive connection to the incidents giving rise to the lawsuit. So accident occurred in Maryland. We're going to look to Maryland law, and you would have a West Virginia state court applying Maryland state law, right, to two West Virginia citizens.
So this happens even just in state court, ignoring the federal thingy.
That's exactly right. Okay. And those are called choice of law rules, okay? And it means exactly what it says. How does a state choose which law to apply? Because it can apply laws that are not its own. A lot of people are confused by that concept, and we've talked about that before.
Yeah, but
state can apply out-of-state laws all the time. So a federal court does the same thing. A federal court sitting in West Virginia would say, what would a West Virginia state court do to pick the law here, and I'm going to do whatever that court would do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think that's what I was getting at. I think it sounds like another one where I got it right, but I wouldn't say I understood all of it. I think that probably A is not the second best answer. It sounds like if you're a lawyer, you'd just be like, well, A is stupid. You're a dummy, Coin, for picking that. What would you think would be like the second best answer? Is it maybe just C?
Yes, I think C is probably the second best answer, which you called out as an attractive distraction.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so the question would be, so C says that the court makes its own determination as to choice of law, and D says it applies the state choice of law rules. Mm-hmm. And in the absence of anything to the contrary, the answer is you apply the state choice of law rules. The broader principle is that a federal court sitting in diversity applies the procedural rules of the state court in which it resides.
Well, I nailed it. Probably didn't, you know, I gave the coin a bad check, but the coin could have just agreed with me, you know?
Like, yeah, why,
that's, yeah, it always had that option.
Coin. Yeah,
we're going to have to really talk about some metaphysics to discuss how it had that option, but, you know, it did, apparently. We've got to see who our big winner is this week.
All right, Thomas, this week's winner is Matthew Cravat on Twitter, who writes, today's T3BE answer D must be right because it feels like it's from Labyrinth when Sarah faces the truth lie door guards. Ask the state which law it would apply and apply that. Wait a minute. Is that right? I don't know. I never understood it. Fantastic reference to Labyrinth. David Bowie at his best? Question mark. Anyway, you got it right. You threw in an early 80s reference. You know how to pander to us. Everyone give Matthew a follow. That is at MATTHEWKREVAT at Matthew Cravat on Twitter. And congratulations, Matthew, for being this week's winner.
Thanks so much for listening. And we'll see you on Friday.
Until then,
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law-talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.